Hey guys, we're going to kick things off by discussing the Robert Kraft news. Then Jenny and Connor come in to discuss all the hot topics at the NFL Combine. And as always, we wrap things up with a six-pack of your Twitter questions. Let's go. All right, welcome back in. It is Combine Week. It's the MMQB podcast with Albert Breer. We're going to preview everything about the NFL Combine wall-to-wall here on the podcast today. We've got some natural sound, I'd say, going on. We got Connor's house. We got my house. We got a whole bunch of kids making noise, playing songs. So that'll be part of the soundtrack this week, too. Is that a dog? Is that a dog? That's not my dog. That's your dog?
Yeah, that's another one. Yeah. We got that's going to be
two
in
dogs
the mix,
this week.
Too. Yep.
What's your dog's name, Connor?
Ernie.
Okay, so we got Connor and Ernie. Okay,
I have no dogs and no children. I'm safely in a soundproof recording studio in New York, so none of the ambient noise is my fault.
All right, so I do want to start with the big news of the weekend, and I'm going to get to it by sort of explaining why I think we're here with Robert Kraft. And this goes back, and this is probably, I'd say, 5 or 6 years ago, and it's a conversation that I immediately remembered having when, you know, I started to see the reaction in response to the charges coming out on Robert Kraft on Friday. And this was just something that popped in my head. And I think Jason Gay, the Wall Street Journal, wrote a column that sort of alluded to this sort of thing, too. I remember having this conversation about how I addressed the commissioner in a press conference. And I'd always just referred to him as Roger. He was not the commissioner of the NFL when I started covering the league. My second year covering the league, he became the commissioner. And I'd always referred to him as Roger. Most of the people I'd been around had referred to him as Roger. And so somebody, and I'm not going to embarrass this person because I think this person was trying to help me in some way, but I had somebody come up to me and say, you know, I think it would be beneficial for you and for him. I think it would enhance your questions. I think it would enhance who he is. If in this setting, in a press conference setting, in a television setting, you referred to him as Mr. Commissioner. And I remember, yeah, I wasn't disrespectful in the moment. I was like, all right, I'll consider that. I never considered it. I just remember that moment. And I remember at that point, I sort of started to make a point of not referring to these guys as Mr. anymore at all. And, you know, I think before that, I didn't really do it before that either. I may have at times said it in reference to some of the older owners, like Dan Rooney while he was still alive, just because of his age. I think there was just maybe like a respecting, or maybe, you know, now and again, maybe I referred to him as Mr. Rooney. But I just at that point tried to make a point of, I don't want to refer to these guys as Mr. because, like, they aren't statesmen. They aren't they aren't these leaders of the country. They're people who are very successful in their fields, who have parlayed that into owning football teams, or they inherited football teams. And you look at the owners who've gotten themselves in trouble now over the last few years. I mean, look, like, you know, Jerry Richardson was a professional football player, then started a supermarket chain that he bought a football team. Robert Kraft was great at selling paper. He bought the parking lot to a football stadium. Then he bought the football stadium. Then he bought the football team. Jim Irsay inherited a football team. And so I'm not saying these guys aren't very successful with what they do. I'm not saying that a lot of these guys aren't like decent people. What I am saying is that in a lot of cases, I feel like these guys have been elevated to a certain level where it's, why are we referring to them as Mr.? Why are we acting in deference to them? Like, why? Like, where did that start? Where did that come from? And I think that's part of the reason why a story like this becomes such a big deal. This is why, like, a much more serious story that's connected to this sort of becomes almost like a side note to the fact that a single person has got himself caught up in it. And like that part of it is just, it's hard for me to look at this and say, you know, that a huge part of this isn't about who Robert Kraft is. It's about who everybody wanted to, it's about how everyone has made out all of these guys and crafted, I think, a higher level than maybe any of them. It's who these guys are made out to be. And like most of these guys are very, again, very successful businessmen who, you know, parlayed that business success into owning a sports teams or inherited these sports teams. And they aren't statesmen. They aren't like they aren't these like they aren't the most important people in the world. And I just it just always hits me when these things happen, because it's like we shouldn't be surprised. Like, and I don't know, Jenny, Connor, I think I'm having trouble organizing all of this in my head. You know what I mean? But it's just like I've always been kind of creeped out by the idea that we are referring to people as Mr. This or Mr. That. Like when. Like what exactly are they doing? Like they own sports teams. Like that's great. Like they enter like those sports teams bring a lot of joy to a lot of people, and that's awesome. But I just like that part of it. Like the way we build them up is kind of, and it's on them for sort of embracing that, you know, because you do see a lot of that. It's on them for embracing that. It's weird to me, like how. I don't know, like, and I don't know why this is the first thing that popped in my head, but it just did when you're going through the whole thing, you know. And it's just, I feel like these people are built up to this high level, and that's such a big part of why the fall, when something like this happens, can be so precipitous.
Right, and you know, I think you wrote in MMQB this morning, it's why the public is surprised, whereas you, if you're in the business, it's not, you know, you recognize the fact that, you know, there are going to be situations that you're going to cover that are maybe not exactly along these lines, right? But you recognize the fact that it's a possibility in our jobs to cover something like this. It's interesting because on Tuesday was when they first announced the, you know, bust of the sex trafficking ring. Authorities in Martin County, Florida, which is, you know, just north of Jupiter.
Right.
And it didn't really get a lot of attention.
It didn't register.
It didn't register. It did not register until Friday when Robert Kraft's name was linked to it. It didn't register on a national scale. And because his name is linked to it, it really has put sex trafficking into the national spotlight in a way that I think people who work in that space probably feel like it's been really underrepresented or not very well understood, right?
And well, so, do you think that's a good thing though, Jenny? Like is that like, because I talked to a couple of people like over the last couple of days that said like this is part of why law enforcement wants to attach big names to these sorts of cases, because A, they feel like it'll bring more attention to what's going on, and B, it'll serve as a deterrent. So, you know, in the future, maybe more people will know, like, hey, if I get involved in A, that might be linked to B. And like the way it was sort of positioned to me was like when they can pin it on someone and create a news cycle the way that they did over the last few days, like maybe they can actually break down the economy of how some of these things work.
In hearing law enforcement talk about it, they were asked repeatedly, you know, how would you describe Robert Kraft's role in this? I mean, that was the one name that came up over and over, of course, right? Because it was the biggest name. And they basically said the market exists for this because there are people willing to pay, right? There are end users is what they kept referring it to. So he's the end user of a sex trafficking ring. So he, you know, goes in there for, you know, to receive some kind of service, and it's probably he has no knowledge of all of the tentacles, but you know, when the police started investigating this, they realized that they wanted to pursue it as more than just prostitution, because they saw the condition in which the women were living. They felt as though, you know, the conditions were barely hygienic, and they were sleeping there, and the women came to this country under the guise of something very different from the job that they took. They came here to be maids or to work in restaurants, and all of a sudden they're living in a massage parlor, and didn't realize that they had probably signed up for this kind of employment. And so that's where I think this is really a poorly understood topic. I think people hear human trafficking, they hear sex trafficking, and they don't really know what that means. And honestly, when this story broke, I didn't quite understand all of the tentacles, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, they described this as this, you know, they're investing it as, you know, this international operation that stretched over several counties in Florida and several states and $2 to $3 million of assets. And I just thought, this, how could something be this big? But you hear them describe exactly how it works and how it's set up. And I think it's the kind of thing that it's really shined a light on something that I think is poorly understood in our country.
No, I'm with you 100%. Like I didn't know, like in, I mean, look, I think we've all heard about how some of these Asian massage parlors work in the past. That's not a secret, but I never would have made the connection from one to the other. And maybe, I mean, I think it's plausible that maybe Kraft didn't make that connection either. Otherwise, maybe he wouldn't have gone in there, you know? And it's just like that piece of it that, like, I didn't, like, you sort of think of human trafficking, and I've heard about it, like, you know, okay, like, it's a big deal at the Super Bowl, and they're trying to curb it at the Super Bowl. And the Patriots have actually given money to try to eradicate some of these issues. You don't really I don't know, Connor. Like, I guess I didn't make that link. You know what I mean? Like, you hear about it, and you feel like it's something so far away. And then it's like, oh, well, it's involved with this that you've heard of and that you've heard of. And it just – I don't know. I mean, I guess it sort of worked on me, right? Like that, like this big name was attached to it. I probably wouldn't have paid much attention to it over the weekend if it hadn't just like landed on my doorstep like that. And now I kind of can see all these different tentacles, you know, that like all this different stuff that's sort of linked to it that I never would have connected it to.
Yeah, I mean, and just the opportunity, I think there was some great reporting done, you know, in the wake of that and, you know, kind of tracing everything back to where these women came from. And I think that it is a common strategy used by police because everything needs a practical example to hit home for people, you know. And I think that these nebulous terms, like Jenny said, like human trafficking, sort of always just exist in a cloud above our heads because we hear it so often. But until you see what it means in practicality, you know, every town – you know, or, you know, every few towns has a place like this. You know what I mean? There was a place like this when in my hometown when I was born, you know, where I grew up, that got closed down, you know, because of stuff like this. But you never think about it because it's just something that kind of comes in and out of your life. But all of a sudden, now that we're a name like that is attached to it, you start reading about the details. You start reading about all the horrible conditions and the lives that are changed and ruined by something like this. And so, yeah, I mean, you know, as much as you want to say, oh, well, it's this or that, I do think it's a positive because, you know, these women deserve, you know, deserve their day. They deserve a chance to kind of right the ship here because this is it's an awful thing that's happened to them.
And guys, you know what I immediately thought of was, did you guys see that? I think it was ESPN that did the documentary. It was like a long form documentary on the World Cup in Qatar, right? And like what they were doing with the workers that they were bringing, I believe it was from India, from different parts of Asia. They were bringing them in under the guise of, you know, real jobs and like bringing them to Qatar to build these stadiums and basically enslaving them. I mean, did you guys see that? It was probably 2-3 years ago. Like, and I think it was, I want to say it was Jeremy Schapp that did this, like just this long form documentary piece on it. And you look at that stuff and it was like the most horrible thing you've ever seen. Like the way that these people are treated, the way that the whole operation over there is working. And like, you're like, how could they not take the World Cup away from this country? And then you hear about this and it's like, God, that's like, I mean, not that different. And that's happening here. Like that's happening in Jupiter, Florida.
Yeah.
Like so, that's what was crazy. That was one piece of it that, like, you know, you sort of think of these things sometimes as being so far away and then you find out it's like right down the street.
Yeah. And I think, you know, human trafficking and sex trafficking have always been this very abstract concept, and that, you know, experts in the field, I've heard over the last several years, you hear more and more about trafficking, but I feel like the understanding, there's just been a gap. And now essentially you understand that, okay, these women working in a massage parlor didn't speak English, so there's no way they could have been licensed to perform the job that they were ostensibly performing. So it's like you can sort of connect the dots and see the chain. And I think it is very educational because you think, okay, maybe, you know, you're deciding the men who were charged as the Johns in this case are being charged with soliciting prostitution. But you sort of see the ripple effects of that act, right? If you go back down the chain, you recognize that, you know, it's connected to the ring. And so I think this is really just a very clear picture of how it happens in a strip mall in Jupiter, Florida, right? Which, you know, it's so easy to picture in your head, which I think for a lot of people, we haven't had an example like that.
I mean, I was at my parents', my parents have a place there every winter, like a timeshare place down there. in Jupiter, and I was there. Like, this is like the crazy part about for me was I was in Jupiter until 90 minutes before the news broke. And it's just, you just think about like how it was right there. I don't know. It's just like the good thing that's going to come out of this, I think, is that like maybe we all, because we couldn't, because you can't ignore it when it lands, like for us in our jobs, it like lands right there. And maybe for football fans who didn't know, like maybe they just, you know, maybe this is what prompts them to look at it. But I mean, I guess you can understand why law enforcement wants to have big names attached to these cases. You know, it just, in that sense, it does make sense that even though, you know, Kraft might walk away with a fine here, like there's still going to be an impact that this had because we all became a little more educated on it.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, you know, and I think it's, you know, if there's good that can come of it, then, you know, that's what you have to take, you know, that's what you have to look for in something like this.
Okay. In the next 2 days, we're going to turn the page here, and there's no easy way to transition to football stuff from that, but we are going to turn the page over the next 2 days. All three of us are going to be going to Indianapolis for the scouting combine. I love this time of year. I think it's sort of the unofficial turning of the page to the 2019 season. Everybody, every power broker in the NFL, at least on the football side, will be in Indianapolis over the next week. Just for everybody who doesn't know, this is more than just college kids running 40s and lifting weights. It is agents meeting with teams, you know, free agent deals being sort of like the beginning stages of free agent deals being worked out, teams meeting with other teams, potential trades being worked out, of course, assessing all of the college players on hand, a ton of socializing that goes on. It really is, I think, in the NFL, the closest thing there is to what would be a trade show in another business. And so we're going to have that covered at the MMQB over the next week, wall to wall. And so I figured this week, instead of going just news topics, I figured we just hit five combine topics, five things that aren't maybe specifically all about the college players, but five combine topics. And to make that really sing, I thought it was time to hand the pen back over to Connor Orr to copyright this. And so, Connor, not only did we give you the honors this week of actually giving some spice, that's the right word, right? Spice? Some spice.
I think that's the word I like to use, yeah.
Right, spice to the reads. We're also going to give you combine topic, not news topic, combine topic number one.
That's right. All right, well, the stage is set for Oklahoma quarterback Kyler Murray at this week's combine, where he's a chance to erase the chorus of doubters who have ensnared his campaign to become the top quarterback selected in the 2019 draft. He's reportedly arriving in Indianapolis at 206 pounds, giving him roughly the same measurements as yours truly, MMQB staff writer Connor Orr. So,
wow. Wait, so you're checking in at what, 5'9", 206, but you're saying you're 5'10"? Is that right?
That's kind of what I've been doing, depending on the shoes, you know. And but arm strength, everything else like that, pretty fairly similar across the board.
Gotcha. So, I can't talk enough about this kid. I think it's so fascinating, you know, and it's funny, as I was doing my report in the last couple of days, I kept bringing up the subject of Doug Flutie. And the reason why, you know, I covered Doug Flutie at the tail end of his career. In 2006, he was, or 2005, he was the backup to Tom Brady in New England. I was in my first year on the Patriots beat. And I actually happened to be at a suburban newspaper that was like his town, the town he grew up in, was one of our core towns. And so we covered him as if he was a beat. And so I got to know Doug a little bit. And one thing I still remember that sticks with me is that I don't think he ever let go of the bitterness over not making it in the NFL. And that's what's so fascinating about this, right, is I think Doug, and there are probably a lot of other quarterbacks, 5'9", 5'10", quarterbacks that are this way too. Doug always felt like with him, it was just the fact that it wasn't his fault that he didn't make it in the NFL. It was NFL team's fault. It was the league's fault for not giving him opportunity. And that's, to me, I think almost at the root of this Kyler story, what's so interesting about it is how many quarterbacks out there, how many like great college quarterbacks over the years out there are probably sitting at home over this weekend rooting for Kyler Murray and saying, Kyler Murray is going to show the NFL that we all could have made it. And so that's what's so cool about this, because he's different than, you know, I think Baker Mayfield. He's different than Russell Wilson, that he's short and he's small. Like, he's 5'9". He's a little slight. He looks small out there on the field. And so that's what I think, guys, is so fascinating about. Like, Jenny, like, I look at this and I just, like, this to me is like, okay, like, Doug Flutie didn't get his opportunity. A lot of other 5'9" quarterbacks didn't get their opportunity. Let's see if all those guys were right all along.
Yeah, and, you know, I do think, you know, Baker has sort of embraced the idea that people, you know, told him he was too small, and that's become sort of his persona. And he said last year, you know, I asked him about the smaller quarterback, shorter quarterback question, and he said, you know, we just have to keep it going so that guys younger than us will continue to have opportunities. And to your point, it's twofold for Kyler. It's not just the height, it's the weight. There's going to be a lot of attention on what exactly he weighs in and at the combine. I think this is probably one of the more interesting combine measurements, right? I mean, we always
like
hear
most.
It. Like, yeah, I mean, probably the most. I mean, we always hear stuff about hand size, blah, blah, blah. But this is like height and weight. Everyone wants to know.
Right. I don't think there's any question. Like, I can remember height being a big deal. Like, I can remember, like, Baker, like, last year, height was a big deal, you know?
Manziel, like, too, I think.
What's he going to measure in at? I don't think anybody was concerned about Baker, because Baker looks like he's a stocky dude, you know? Like Russell Wilson, same way. Like, Russell Wilson probably weighs 220 pounds now. And he wasn't a first-round prospect, so there wasn't the same level of scrutiny. But even then, you weren't concerned about his weight. Like, I think this is probably the most anticipated Connors stepping on a scale, maybe in NFL history.
Yeah, right. Because there's really no weight thing to the contrary. I mean, maybe somebody coming in a few pounds overweight, you know, maybe like on the offensive or defensive line side. But yeah,
like,
I mean,
Orlando Brown last year or whatever.
Exactly. Yeah, but right. Even then, it's like not something that we've looked at, kind of moving, you know, into that space. I mean, I guess Manti Te'o to a certain degree, because there was a lot of talk about him going into that combine and about his size knocking him down anyway. And so there was some discussion there in terms of what he would weigh in at and everything like that. But yeah, I mean, this is going to be like, you know, the total meat market scenario. It's everybody staring at this scale and wondering what this poor kid is going to weigh in at. But I wonder, you know, maybe a fun week for him in terms of just, you know, packing away a few extra burritos, or, you know, maybe, you know, get to go to your favorite restaurant two or three times a day to add a few LBs, which is, you know, nothing wrong with that.
Right. Cause I, like, you remember the old, and this is like, I'm not, you remember like the old high school wrestler tricks, right? Like, I played football with a bunch of high school wrestlers, and I remember towards the end of the season, they'd be doing like this weird stuff because they knew they were going to have to make weight in a couple weeks, you know? And like back then, like that was before we knew a lot. So there are all kinds of crazy things they were doing. Now this would be the reverse of that, I suppose. Right. So like drinking a lot of water, I would think, not going to the bathroom. There's probably some tricks he can pull here.
Definitely.
If you remember,
a lot of water. Yeah.
Right.
Way back in the day, back when it was MTV True Life. Do you remember MTV True Life?
I do remember the name of that. Well, like, which one was that? That was.
But there was Ryan Harris, the future Super Bowl winning offensive tackle from the Denver Broncos. He was on there as a high school kid going into Notre Dame, and so there was a whole thing about organic weight gain from him, and, you know, like he was at like graduation parties, just like shoveling away like pounds of like brown rice and chicken and all this kind of stuff. And so I'm sure that's like sort of the deal with Kyler Murray right now. He probably is in a sad place where he just doesn't want to see another, you know, piece of grilled chicken again for the rest of his life.
I don't know if that's a sad place to be. I don't know.
I think he should stay away from fettuccine Alfredo, though. Once before a swim meet in my non-gluten-free days, I took carb loading a little too far at the Olive Garden, and then right before the 100 butterfly, I puked behind the blocks. So
right before
the race.
How'd you swim?
Did they have to clear the pool?
No, they didn't. It wasn't in the water. It was just on the deck.
Did you do okay in the race?
I think I did okay. Yeah, yeah.
So
know,
maybe it worked.
Through.
So it sort of worked.
Well, yeah, maybe. Yeah, I mean, I think that Kyler Murray and I are similar athletes. So what applies to me would probably apply to him as well.
Yeah, I don't know. I just think it's going to be really, really interesting to see that, to see whether he runs, to see whether he throws. You know, like I think that the, to me, like there's, if I'm him, I don't say this about everybody, but if I'm him, I think I probably do everything just because, like, you know, this is like the prospect that like NFL teams have to play catch up on the most, because NFL teams were being told, don't even waste your time on the guy in September and October, right? When everybody thought he was going to go play baseball. And so, like, I think teams are still sort of playing catch up, still getting to know him. And I do think, like, because he's not, like, slam dunk top five pick, like, I do think he can help himself by saying, okay, I'm going to do everything. I'm going to put myself out there. I'm going to show you guys why there's all this buzz about me. I'm going to justify all the talk out there. So I do think he can help himself, especially because, and I talked to Lincoln Riley last week, and Lincoln actually told me that the only time they tested him in the 40, he ran low 4.3s, and that was when he was in his in the worst shape that Lincoln had ever seen him when he first transferred from Texas A&M. So low 4.3s at that point. And I don't know. I mean, like, I feel like he can, like, if this kid comes out and runs like a 4.28, like, I mean, buckle up, because like the hype machine is going to explode at that point.
I might, you know, I might disagree with you in the sense that, like, I might not throw because, you know, you want teams to see what you can do, and you want to see it kind of on your terms. You know what I mean? Like, I think that there is a chance, and I agree with what you're saying, right? You know, you're kind of taking it from that scout's perspective where you want to see a gamer. You want to see a guy who doesn't care and says that I'll throw to anybody, anytime, anywhere. But I think that we're sort of past that a little bit. I mean, honestly, like that attitude, you know, I think that someone's going to draft him anyway. And I think that it's so much of it now is about putting on that show that accentuates the best of what you can do. And so, you know, come to my pro day, here's my receivers. Here's me rolling out. Here's me doing exactly what I do at Oklahoma, which is what you're going to make, which is what you're going to do for me in the NFL, you know, and because otherwise, you know, what's the point? You know, I think that, you know, I think from his, you know, if I'm his agent, I'm saying there's really not a lot of good that can happen from throwing at the combine.
See, this is the way. All right. So this is the way that I look at that. All right. I think if you're the number one guy, like, I probably shut it down for certain things, right? Like, if you're undisputed number one guy, if you are Quinnen Williams right now from Alabama, and you know you're at the top of the heap for the defensive tackles, if you're Nick Bosa from Ohio State, and he's gotten out in the injury that he's coming off of, you know, like, if you're a clear number one at your position, I would advocate, like, sitting out some things. I just think that if you're in a position where you may be chasing a little bit, or you're really fighting to where you could make like a $5 million difference by being drafted a few spots higher, I just think you give yourself every chance. And here's the thing, Connor. Like, to me, it's like, I think back to Teddy Bridgewater and how bad, like, his pro day was, right? Like, he didn't really have a chance to make up for that after that, right? Like, and I feel like if you're just okay throwing the ball at the combine, you still have your pro day to sort of make up for it. I really don't think we wind up killing anyone for throwing poorly at the combine. And I do think there's upside if you look really good. And then if you do really good, then maybe you just don't throw at your pro day. You know, I just think giving yourself multiple shots and then putting as much information out there on yourself can be helpful.
Yeah. And I think that teams like it. They prefer it when quarterbacks throw. Like, I remember last year, there were a lot of teams that were really bummed that Darnold didn't throw. Now, the impact that has on an individual's draft status, I think that's probably variable, as you guys have said. Yeah. You know, I think it depends on the prospect and how much the team already loves them. But if there is if there is a small chance that it would improve your stock, and I think in Murray's case there probably is, then I do think it's worth it.
Yeah, I really, look, the reason the teams like the combine is because everything's apples to apples, right? Like, you're getting to see everyone in the exact same environment. Like, they're benching in the same environment, they're running in the same environment, they're throwing, they're catching, they're doing drills. Everything's in the same environment. So you sort of get this apples to apples view where you don't have to consider, well, this guy was on grass and that guy was outside and the wind was at his back. Like, you're not worrying about that in Indianapolis because everyone's performing under the same circumstances. And so I think that, you know, giving I think like as a passer, I think he's still chasing Dwayne Haskins, right? Like, I think he's still like, there's still perception out there. Dwayne Haskins is a more refined, more developed passer than Kyler Murray. I think this is an opportunity to close the gap. Haskins is throwing. Okay. Like, all right. Like, I'm going to give them a chance to see side by side what I look like against Dwayne Haskins. And I do think that, I mean, look, maybe it's not fair, but I do think that there is that piece of it that's like, I want my quarterback to be competitive, you know, like, and I want him to want to get out there and show I'm better than everybody else here. And so whether it's fair or not, I think that's another way you can help yourself.
That segues nicely into the next topic.
All right. You want to read it?
Sure.
All right.
While this week will be about Kyler Murray, a growing legion of draft yappers are beginning to view Ohio State's Dwayne Haskins and Missouri's Drew Locke as the best quarterback prospects in this year's pool. Haskins will throw this week and potentially take a stranglehold on the consensus opinion as to who is the most complete quarterback in the 2019 rookie class. It was as if you knew this topic was coming. You already got this conversation started, Albert.
We got it going. And I like the word yappers, too. That's I'm not sure I had that one in my vocabulary, but I'm adding it right now.
That's my goal every week, is just to sort of expand everyone, you know, just like a word-a-day calendar, you know what I mean? Just sort of add it to your lexicon.
Yep. So I think one thing we need to be careful with about this year's group, I think we need to be careful about manufacturing prospects, you know. And it was interesting when I was talking to people over the last couple of days, and I asked, like, how do these guys compare against last year's class? And I got a pretty strong consensus that, like, Baker and Sam Darnold and Josh Rosen were better prospects last year than any of these kids are this year. And I think what can happen is when quarterbacks aren't there, we sort of start to manufacture them. Here's where I'll divide this. And again, like, I've seen a lot of Haskins, obviously, because of where I went to school. I've seen some of Locke. I'm not an evaluator. I'm just going on what people have told me and what I've heard. It feels to me like Haskins is a legitimate franchise quarterback prospect. It feels a little bit to me like Locke is being manufactured to some degree. And there are other draft years where we've seen that happen. Like, that's how Christian Ponder winds up going 12th overall. That's how EJ Manuel winds up going 16th overall. I think in cases like that, teams predetermine, okay, I'm taking a quarterback in the first round. And then whether there's a legitimate franchise quarterback there or not, they're going to manufacture one, right? Like, they're going to make it so, like, okay, like, we're coming away from this draft with a quarterback. And so I think that's what you need to be careful with this year versus where we were last year, where I think Haskins is. I think Locke is borderline. I think Daniel Jones is borderline. And I think that's where teams have to be careful this year. It's not the same as last year where, you know, I think they have to look at it and say, let's be careful not to try to create something just because we want it to be there for us.
And I think teams were planning for that, right? The talk last year was always, this is a fantastic class. There will be five in the first round. And we know that 2019 is a down year. So if you need a quarterback, you know, you should jump on one in 2018, which is why the Giants' decision was questionable. And has been hotly debated since for that exact reason, because people knew what was coming up in 2019.
Yep. And they had, like, they're drafting second overall last year. It was right there in the fairway for them. And they had a chance to do it, you know, and like Connor, like, I look at it too, like, this is why I like the Flacco trade. And I know we talked about it last week, and I don't want to beat it into the ground, but at least, like, having Joe Flacco under contract for the next 3 years gives you the flexibility. So, I mean, and look, like, I don't know what we're going to think of Tua Tagovailoa next year at this time. I don't know what we're going to think of Justin Herbert at this time next year. I don't know what we're going to think of Jake Fromm at this time next year. But I do feel like there are going to be some teams, like the Jets and Browns were this way 2 years ago. There are going to be some teams, I think, that are going to look at the two classes side by side and try to make a decision on whether or not to wait, which I think is a smart way to look at it if you're a team.
Well, next year, right, we'll be debating spin rates for left-handed quarterbacks versus right-handed quarterbacks. And and, you know, it'll be a whole different sort of minutia. But I wonder if, you know, the understanding has evolved a little bit. Like, I know you never want to manufacture a starting quarterback, but has the meaning of that changed, like, over the years? You know what I mean? Like, back when Christian Ponder was taken, the example that you gave, I mean, maybe, you know, definitely not ready for the NFL, but is there a blame on, you know, the team that took him and tried to force him into an offense, fit a square peg into a round hole, and is that changing to the point where, you know, if you draft someone like Drew Lock, who is borderline, or Kyler Murray, it's no longer, you know, really, the understanding has evolved to the point where you're no longer forcing something, you're signing up to create what has made this person successful. You know what I mean?
Right.
Has the understanding evolved to the point where,
like, you're saying, you're meeting him halfway, sort of, right?
Yeah, and it's no longer like it's no longer the, you know, the Blaine Gabbert and Christian Ponder thing where, you know, all these guys just sort of, you know, they're like the ducks at a carnival game. They just keep getting shot off, and, you know, and we never see or hear from them again. But, you know, is it different now where teams have more information at their disposal? They have more chances to make this work. And so if you take somebody up there, it's not really that you're manufacturing something. It's that you believe that you can create something for this person. Is that any different than it was before, I guess?
I think that's fair. I mean, I think there's probably more focus on, like, what you're developing around the quarterback, like, both from, like, you know, personnel standpoint and a scheme standpoint. And, you know, you mentioned the 11 draft. I mean, I think that's such a perfect example of it, right? Where if you look at it, I mean, literally the first half of the first round, and I'm looking at, I've got it in front of me now. I mean, there could be like 8 Hall of Famers there. Like, and I mean, it's ridiculous if you think about it. Like, okay, so the top 12, right? So Cam Newton's the first pick. So move him aside. Picks 2 through 12, all right? The non-quarterbacks, Von Miller, Marcel Darius, A.J. Green, Patrick Peterson, Julio Jones, Alden Smith, Tyron Smith, J.J. Watt, all right? That's the non-quarterbacks. The 3 quarterbacks mixed in there, Jake Locker, Blaine Gabbert, Christian Ponder. I mean, it's just, it's like, so you look at that year and it's like, that's when guys got pushed up the board. But you're right, Connor. I mean, I think probably 7 years ago or 8 years ago, like, maybe, like, you know, Jacksonville looked at Blaine Gabbert coming out of Mizzou and thought to themselves, well, this guy's a project, we'll give him time and everything else. Whereas now it's like, all right, let's put Missouri's offense in. You know what I mean? And, like, let's be creative and make this work a different way. That probably gives the quarterback a better shot, you know? I think you're right on that. And we probably have less busts now too. I don't know. It's unscientific, but I feel like there are less guys busting out the last few years. Maybe it's a result of that.
Just better understanding, you know.
There you go. There you
people
go.
Helping people.
All right. So, combine topic number 3. We're going to flip over to the other side. Connor, another good job of putting this one together. Let us not forget, this is a defensive draft. We're likely to see a pass rusher go with the number 1 overall pick, should the Cardinals remain in place. There are solid arguments to be made that without trades, we could see defensive talent populate the entire top 5. Of course, part of that, I'm assuming, Connor, what you're referring to there is the fact that the teams picking in the top 5 all have long-term answers at the quarterback position. And so, yeah, I mean, I think that that's absolutely a possibility here. If there are teams that are just drafting strictly off of what they see, I mean, look, I think Nick Bosa, Quinnen Williams, Josh Allen, like, those 3 are probably the 3 best prospects in the draft. Like, I've heard Jeffrey Simmons' name, if he was healthy, I've heard he would have been in that group. Of course, he's got all kinds of complicating factors with what happened 3 years ago when he was in high school. It does feel like one of those drafts where if you just, like, no matter where your need is, if you just say, we're going to take the best player, we're going to look at this and say, like, this is a good defensive draft, and we're going to tap into that, you're probably going to wind up with a better player than you would otherwise.
I would be surprised if the entire top 5 was defense.
I think that there's a chance. I'm going to say this here for the first time. I think there's a chance that Arizona really considers taking Kyler. I also think there's a chance that he falls a little bit in the first round. I don't think it's really crystallized where he's at right now. And I know that sounds like a cop out. I do think that there is a, I think that Cliff Kingsbury's love for Kyler Murray is legitimate. Whether or not it's enough to make Arizona as a organization move off of Josh Rosen, that's a different story. I'm not sure if that's there, but I don't think it's something that wouldn't be discussed internally because of how the organization is going all in on what on what Cliff Kingsbury is bringing to the table. And so I think I think there's a good chance we see a quarterback or two go in the top five as a result of trade ups. And I mean, if I'm the Jets, if I'm the Niners, if I'm the Cardinals, I'm probably kicking the tires pretty seriously on the idea of moving down and saying, is there a way that I can turn, because the second and third rounds are really strong, is there a way maybe I can turn one pick into two or three picks here?
Definitely. You know, those top five picks are always so fluid, right? You know, teams that don't need a quarterback are, you know, looking for ways to move down, even if it's one spot, right? Like the 49ers did, right? They moved down one spot when the Bears wanted Trubisky.
Right.
So,
yep.
You know, I think it's...
We look at it here. Okay, Arizona, like, is a probably no. The Niners are a no. The Jets are a no. The Raiders are a probably no. The Bucks, I'd say, are a probably no. And then you have the Giants at six, which I think is the first team that would be... I think the Giants are probably the first trade up candidate if you look at the group.
And the Jets, you know, just went up last year to get Darnold, so they would, you know, would welcome draft capital from moving down. There's just a lot of possibilities. It's hard
right.
to know, and it would definitely require a team falling in love with a guy. But I think your point about Murray is a good one, Albert. Just based on Kingsbury's own comments, we can't rule that out, right? I mean, I know that was before he was an NFL head coach, but he obviously thinks very highly of Murray. And other than manufactured statements from the team, we don't really know exactly what he and the team think of Rosen.
Do you guys want to hear a fun fake trade that just popped in my head the other day?
I would love to hear a fun fake trade.
Fun fake trade? Antonio Brown for Josh Rosen. How fun?
I'm sure that's a fun fake trade, right? Ben Roethlisberger would love a cerebral backup who speaks his mind on the roster. I'm sure that
who
would
thinks
be
he's smarter
totally
than everybody else?
Totally welcome.
That is very spicy, Albert.
Like, can you imagine that they trade away Ben Roethlisberger's number one weapon? I mean, but that would also, you know what? I would sort of like that would be kind of a gangster move by Colbert and Tomlin, who've shown Ben all of this respect over the last week, right? And then they say, okay, you want AB gone? Fine. Look who we're bringing in for him.
Josh Rosen can be one of his 52 children.
I honestly don't know why that popped in my head, but it just, to me, like for one reason or another, it just like sort of makes sense, right? Like it's sort
Having
of
him
like.
Go to the Giants, I think, makes sense too. I mean, you know, I think that he's a perfect quarterback for the Giants, you know. I mean, if they're not sold for anybody else, you know, I know they did a lot of work on him last year, and, you know, I think that they could certainly work something out too. I don't think it's totally crazy, but, man, I mean, it would be the best example yet of teams no longer sticking to this rigid thing where we have to, like, just we have to make this person believe he's our franchise quarterback, and we have to make everybody know. I think people are smart enough to know that these conversations are happening all the time now. I mean,
yeah.
No one except for like five or six people are really truly franchise quarterbacks in the NFL.
I mean, look, here's the deal, guys. Like, if you believe, if you're Arizona, right? If you're Cliff Kingsbury, and I like again, like I don't know like how he would stack like Josh Rosen versus Kyler Murray. But if you're Cliff Kingsbury and you believe that Kyler Murray can be a top 10 quarterback in the NFL and you're not completely sold in Josh Rosen, you almost have to do it, don't you?
Absolutely.
You almost have to do it. I'm not saying that would be the right train of thought, the wrong train, but if you believe that, like I don't have any problem at all pulling the ripcord on a quarterback after a year if there's somebody else that you truly believe can be a game changer there.
Right, and we don't know what Kingsbury thinks. We're not saying we do know, but I think that's exactly right, Albert. If you think that Murray could be the guy that would you could have this partnership and could change the fortunes of your franchise, right? I mean, you're a new head coach. You have the number one overall pick. It would be silly to squander that if you really have that much faith that this is the guy.
Right. I remember like having a conversation with, I think I had this conversation with Les Snead like 3-4 years ago. And we were talking about when he first got to the Rams, and we were talking about like, well, hey, what would have, and they had, if you remember, the number two pick that year, right? And that was the year Griffin and Luck were coming out. And like, I remember like this was right when like Bradford was sort of washing out of St. Louis. And I asked him, I said, what if you guys had had the number one pick that year, you know? And what if it was Andrew Luck and not Robert Griffin? And he sort of like smiled, and I think he sort of said, like, yeah, that would have been a decision we would have had to make. Like, I think that like the Rams would have seriously considered in that spot drafting Andrew Luck and trading Sam Bradford. And so like, I always believe in those situations, it's so important to get it right on that position. And if you're like fully convicted on a guy, like if you're fully convicted on a guy, like that this guy is the guy going forward for me, and then I think you move heaven and earth and you worry about the repercussions later.
That would be the craziest, like, I think that would be the craziest thing to happen at the top of the draft in a long time, right? Crazier than anything that I can remember in recent memory.
And I'll tell you what, like, then in 2020, we'd probably be having owners lining up to hand Lincoln Riley a blank check to take their jobs, right? Like whatever it is, 10, 11 months from now. I think that would probably be part of the fallout. So we've got Lincoln Riley in the NFL in 2020 now. We've got Kyler Murray throwing to Antonio Brown in Arizona. And we've got Josh Rosen causing problems behind Ben Roethlisberger in Pittsburgh. That's where we're at?
Please make it happen.
All right. Combine topic number 4, Connor.
All right. Let me get in here. Trade discussions will likely jump a few places on the Scoville scale this weekend's combine, where all the NFL's movers and shakers get in one place to discuss potential deals over hot shrimp cocktail and overpriced steaks. Could this be the place where talks for Antonio Brown and Odell Beckham specifically heat up? I think the Steelers have no choice, really. I mean, unless they want to just say, hey, we're going to totally screw you over. We're not going to get anything for you. We're going to make you sit out and file a grievance and, you know,
well,
do all that kind of stuff.
I don't think they're giving him away, though. I don't think they're giving him away. Like, I think that they're – I don't know. I think there's like a sort of a – there's sort of like an Antonio Davis Pelicans thing going on here to some degree, too, where it's like, we're going to move you when we're good and ready to move you. We're going to move you when it suits us to move you. You know what I mean? Like, I do feel like there's a little bit of that going on.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's certainly, but at the same time, right, I mean, what's the other option for them, right? Just to hold on to him until he doesn't show up for training camp and then deal with that headache. And yeah, I think there is at least some sort of a timeline there, right? They would ideally want to get rid of him before teams start installing stuff before the start of the season, I would guess.
Well, you got the natural deadline of March 17th, like, right, which is when they own the $2.5 million roster bonus. So that's like a natural breaking point. But you could argue, if you're the Steelers, like, well, we're willing to eat that, like, because we're already eating all of this money anyway. And now he becomes even easier to move because that money's off the books. And so, like, now the contract's even more of a commodity for whoever we're trading him to. So, I don't know. I just don't think, like, what would you need in place to trade for him? Like, what would you need him? Like, if you're another team, like, what are the things that you have to have in place to trade for Antonio Brown right now?
Well, I mean, we talked about this before, you know, that there are certain teams he would fit on better than others. You know, your references in MMQB, Albert, and I think this is a really great point. I know you wrote about it earlier this year too, but this guy is a really hard worker. Like, you will not meet a person that doesn't say that Brown is not a hard worker. And, you know, the hardest. I mean, I've been at training camp practices where he's, you know, several years into his career is the last guy catching hundreds of passes off the jugs machines. And I know we have a tendency to blow those things up, you know, last guy off the field. But in his case, he really is extremely committed to, you know, being the best at his position, which he has been, right? So, right. You know, I think you just need to find out from him what went wrong. And I do not believe that you need a top elite receiver to be a successful team. But if there's a team that's looking to sort of change its course a little bit and wants to bring in, a dynamic playmaker, this is not a guy that you have to worry about being lazy. So I think teams need to hear from him what went on. And if his gripe is that he felt like he was working harder than everyone else and maybe people weren't being held to that same standard as he created for himself, then maybe you're more likely to take him on.
Yeah, I think that you probably need like a certain, I think maybe like the number one thing for me, Connor, is like, I feel like you can't be the best player on your team. Like, and I know that sounds weird, but I think so much of it, like I think you need someone, I think you need like a strong leadership infrastructure in place. Like, it's like with the, and we've mentioned the Rams a few times, like the Rams last year, like one of the reasons I think that they were okay bringing in a Sue and okay bringing in, you know, an Aqib Talib and a Marcus Peters was because the best players in their team really were Todd Gurley and Aaron Donald, you know, and those guys were like the right kinds of guys. And so no matter what, like even if those guys went off the rails, it wasn't going to, they weren't going to have the ability to drag a lot of other people down with them because the standard was being set by somebody else. And so I think that part of this has to be like, you have to have really strong standard bearers in place. So if you do hit bumps and he goes off the rails a little bit, he's not going to make your whole place blow up.
I mean, I guess I would challenge outside of New England, really, for anybody to find a place where that truly exists anymore. I mean, I think that the way that
I'll give you a couple, like Philly, Indianapolis, right? Like, I think that those two would be places.
I'll concede Philly. Indianapolis is like year one. Like, there could be a bomb that goes off there and completely destroys that locker room. I mean, there's no way to tell that, you know, there's no way to tell how
Houston?
Something like that would affect there.
No, I'm not saying Houston would trade for him, but like Houston's got a lot of star players that like J.J. Watt, Whitney Merciless, DeAndre Hopkins, like places like that. Like, I feel like, you know, the Packers, I wonder because I sort of feel like Aaron's got some Ben tendencies. You know what I mean? Like, so I wonder about the fit there a little bit. But I think Philly would be interesting because I do feel like they've got like the infrastructure in place to absorb guys now. So I just feel like it's got to be like one of those places where there is strong leadership in place, like where, you know, like, hey, if he flies off the handle for a week or two, like we're going to be able to absorb that. I do think that that's important.
Well, I think any of the places on this list, right, I mean, are all – we're all saying Antonio Brown needs to go to a place where, you know, there's strong personalities, there's strong leadership, there's guys that can do this and that. But these are all things that the Steelers think they already have, which is
right.
Just funny to me that they've convinced themselves that, like, that he is the problem, but everything else is totally – you know, everything else is totally fine. Meanwhile, you know, there are people kind of star players, very good players, kind of jumping ship and not shedding a tear to be there. So I think it's, you know, I just think it's an interesting situation there.
And I think, you know, for other teams looking at it, you know, the fact that it's not just Brown.
All right. So we have some guests. Hey, say hello and then get out of the office, okay?
Steve. Can we have pupusas?
Where do you think Antonio Brown's going to play next year?
Hey, where's Antonio Brown going to play next year, Drew?
I'm here.
He's going to play in here.
Oh,
okay.
Wait, New England. New England.
Yeah, okay, he's going to play in here. You heard it here first from Drew Breer. We are in New England, and he just said that Antonio Brown is going to play in here.
And this is very spicy.
So this is sort of like that. You guys remember that video of the guy like with chaos breaking out in the background? Like, Emily is in here right now trying to direct the kids out of here and not doing a great job of it.
I think you're bearing the lead. I think
I just got a really dirty look. And now she's pointing at the lock on the door, and so it's my fault now for not locking the door.
I think we're really bearing the lead here, which is the possibility that Antonio Brown ends up in New England.
Yeah. Okay.
To see on PFT Albert Breer's son, Colin, Antonio Brown, great fit in New England.
I think we've just broken some major news on this podcast. Right. We might need to send a news alert on SI Wire.
We have Antonio Brown going to New England and Arizona for Josh Rosen, right?
Yes, but see, this one is particularly good because the headline could just simply read Breer, colon, Antonio Brown headed to New England, and it would not be incorrect because A. Breer did predict that.
Oh, man. Okay, so real quick, let's hit Odell Beckham, too. I figure, you know, both you guys covered the Giants. You know, both you guys know that organization pretty well. Let's say in 5 months, when training camp opens, is Odell Beckham going to be a Giant?
I say yes.
Connor?
Yeah, I say yes. And I think the reason that I say yes is because I think that they're a franchise that I think does, not that they don't like to admit that they're wrong, but that they like to exhaust every possible opportunity to fix something or to make something work, because, you know, that's kind of how they've always been. So, you know, and I think that Ernie agrees that, you know, maybe the Giants are definitely pragmatists, and even though this is kind of how Odell feels at this point, you certainly get that vibe from him that he doesn't want to be there and that he wishes he was in a more explosive offense and a kind of on a more of an upward trajectory towards the Hall of Fame, that maybe they believe that there's something amenable that they can come to, some sort of agreement.
Yeah, and that's all that's been like super interesting, the way social media is being used like in a very passive aggressive way. And this isn't just with Odell Beckham. This is like across the NFL, across all sports. And like I'm guessing we'll probably see more of that between now and the start of training camp. And it'll be interesting to see like how tolerant the Giants are of it, because they've already dealt with it in the past.
You know, across all sports, right, the social media, where players have an instant outlet to express something, whether it's a frustration or whatever it may be. I think, you know, we see it in the NBA a lot, too, and it's really sort of changed the dynamic a little bit, because there's this direct window into what a player is thinking at a specific moment of time, or some emoji that's hard to decipher. You know, it's interesting to Connor's earlier point that, like, the teams that players want, like, are not happy on are the Giants and the Steelers, when really in the history of the NFL, like, how many times
crazy
could you say that?
Right. Yeah, I didn't even think about that. That's actually, you know, that's a really good point, Connor, because it's, I mean, normally guys are looking to get out of, like, Cleveland or, you know, Oakland, or, like, it's just, like, you
well, people
don't
are
see
leaving Oakland, Albert, so.
Yeah.
But not necessarily by choice.
Yeah. I don't think like it's just that those are like the flagship franchises for guys to want out of those places is pretty interesting. And I wonder too, like is that a red flag? You know, like so many great players have gone through those places. Like, would you view that as a red flag if you're another team that if he can't make it work in that place, like, I don't know if we're going to be able to make it work here either.
I think teams, like, yeah. Sorry, go ahead, Connor.
Well, I wonder, it's like, is it a red flag, or is it not signaling like a changing of the guard? Because I obviously don't think that Pittsburgh or the Giants or any of those kind of marquee pragmatic franchises, you know, they're not doing anything wrong. You know, I think that they just might have hit sort of a crossroads there. But, you know, is there anything to be said about teams that, you know, have figured out how to kind of be a little bit faster and looser with the rules, make exceptions for certain people, you know, just let it slide for long enough where, you know, you get a guy in for a year and then you cut him loose and, you know, you're not worried about the perception of that. You know, you're not worried about what people are thinking about you as a franchise. And I'm wondering if, like, that model of business has sort of caught up to where the Giants and the Steelers have been forever, which is, like you guys have said, the example of the place where you want to go, the place where you want to move your family because you think you'll be there for longer, that sort of blue chip franchise. And so it's just interesting to see if, like, that notion itself is sort of crumbling a little bit as a lot of these players are able to speak out and speak more freely.
We don't know everything that's going on in either place, but it does feel like where the point where the Steelers are at is one of, how did we get to the point where two star players don't want to be here anymore?
Right.
To the point where one will sit out the season and one is forcing his way out by, you know, demanding a trade. How did the organization get to this point?
It's jarring. It's like
jarring.
Right. It's jarring.
But,
like,
yeah. But I was going to say the Giants are at like a slightly different point, because this is, you know, this has been going on over multiple regimes, right? I mean, since Odell was drafted, they've changed GMs, they've changed coaches twice. And so I do think it's sort of a different question for both teams.
Yeah. Like, I think with the Steelers, that like, I think the other piece of this, like this is sort of the Steelers, like, again, have all, and I know we've talked about this, we've probably like overdone it to some degree. The Steelers have always taken risks on guys and have always had big personalities and have like set their program up so they can take on guys who maybe other teams would have a harder time handling. And like, you do wonder if, you know, maybe they finally reached the breaking point and they have to reevaluate the way that they've done it and whether or not it works going forward. And like, look, I think it's hard to blame them for picking the quarterback over everybody else, but to not acknowledge the quarterback is part of the problem too. I wonder how that's going to resonate in the locker room.
That feels totally insane to me. I mean, that whole statement, I think, just needed to be thought out in more than one way. To the point where you're calling all the other people in the locker room like Ben Roethlisberger's kids, I wonder how that hit with a lot of veteran guys, especially that offensive line, who seems to have a pretty good idea of their own self-importance and value, not in a negative way, but I think that everybody there now gets kind of has an idea of what slice of the pie that they've contributed and what the team would be like without them. And, you know, I just don't know if Ben Roethlisberger is the person to fix it, because if he could fix it, then I feel like he would have fixed it already. I mean, we wouldn't be looking at maybe Le'Veon Bell walking out the door. With Antonio Brown, this would just be like a normal, quiet offseason.
Yeah, I mean, it was the antithesis of what we see for a team like New England, and not to always compare everything to the Patriots, but
right.
To say that there's the quarterback and 52 children was, like, extremely bizarre.
Well, you wrote the story on this too, Jenny, like it was probably 2 years ago now, but like Brady's, it's not even a willingness. It's like an insistence to be treated like everybody else. At least that's the way it was for a long time. And it did cause some friction last year, but like this idea that that Brady, you know, forever did his press conference at his locker instead of at the podium because he didn't want to be different than anybody else. And that like Brady would be willing to take it from Josh McDaniels in the practice field or from Bill in the meeting room. Like it just sort of set the tone for everybody else that like, if I'm willing to be treated like the guy in the middle of the roster, then you need to be willing to be treated like the guy in the middle of the roster too. If your quarterback's different than that, if your quarterback isn't that way, well, you know, then I think it's just, it sort of permeates throughout the roster too. And maybe that's part of it. Like, and look, I think that's part of Antonio Brown's frustration too, is that like that, again, that maybe that's part of the reason why, because he wasn't positioned like that within the organization. You know, maybe the pressure wasn't felt for everybody to be working at the level that Antonio Brown was working at because Ben Roethlisberger was there, and maybe he wasn't doing it the same way that Brown was doing it.
At the very least, the general manager's statement, making that statement on the heels of Brown's apparent, you know, frustrations with Roethlisberger, at the very least, it gives the perception that there is some credence to what Brown is saying.
Right. Okay, we have one more combine topic to go, but first, I'm going to tell you guys about Robinhood. Connor, Jenny, you guys want to hear about Robinhood?
Sounds great.
It's going to be
hair treatment again.
It's going to be fantastic. And no, Connor, we won't have to embarrass you this week. We're going to just tell you about how maybe you can help diversify your investment portfolio. Robinhood is an investing app that lets you buy and sell stocks, ETFs, options, and cryptos all commission-free, while other brokerages charge up to $10 for every trade. Robinhood doesn't charge any commissions, fees, so you can trade stocks and keep all of your profits. Plus, there's no account minimum deposit needed to get started, so you can start investing at any level. The simple, intuitive design of Robinhood makes investing easy for newcomers and experts alike. Very easy to understand charts and market data. You can place a trade in just 4 taps on your smartphone. You can also view stock collections such as 100 most popular. With Robinhood, you can learn how to invest in the market as you build your portfolio, discover new stocks, track your favorite companies, and get custom notifications for price movements so you never miss the right moment to invest. And because I love all you guys out there, I'm going to help you out. We're going to give you guys a special deal here. That's right. Robinhood is giving listeners of the MMQB podcast with Albert Breer a free stock like Apple, Ford, or Sprint to help build your portfolio. You can sign up at Breer.Robinhood.com. That's my last name, B-R-E-E-R, Breer.Robinhood.com. Go there today. We're going to jump right into combine topic number five here. This is a pretty simple one. We always have a random player emerge at the combine and capture our collective imaginations with a stellar workout. Thanks again for the spicy copy, Connor Orr. So who is your Mike Mamula this year? Let's start with you, Jenny.
Well, Rashawn Gary, I think, sounds like he will run absurdly fast for a player of his size. I think he's been clocked, what, in the 4.5 range, which is absurd for someone who weighs 280 pounds. So I think that there's a good chance that he steals the show the day that he works out. I forget which day that is. Probably Sunday, right?
I think D-Limer is Sunday, right? Yep. So, yeah, like 4.5, like, and he's like a kid who was this is a kid who like has been earmarked for the NFL since he was in the eighth grade. And so it's going to be interesting to see how fast he runs, because if he runs a 4.5 at 280 pounds, that'll create plenty of buzz. Connor, who you got?
How about Stanford receiver J.J. Arcega-Whiteside?
I love that guy's name, by the way, from the first time I heard it. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, you know, just a lot to like about J.C., including the fact that I just picked my favorite name off of the list of combine invitees, but you know, just some interesting facts about him. International relations major, 6'3", senior. So you know, I think a lot to like there. But all joking aside, I used to, like, every year before the draft, I would tweet like a sleeper prospect that didn't exist, and so I would try to see if I could get anybody to sort of you know, get on board with that.
Is that catfishing?
is that like my dad? Catfishing? Yeah.
By definition, is that catfishing?
I think so. Right? Why not?
Yeah. So did you get, how effective was this?
Well, not as effective as, you know, I don't know if you guys saw this last week, but there was an actual guy who made people believe that
the recruit thing.
He's like a 3-star recruit, getting like letters from like Iowa and Alabama, and then there's a bunch of blogs that just picked it up and started writing about this guy. Like he was a legitimate left tackle.
Didn't he tweet like, I believe that guy like was like tweeting out like blessed to have it, like hashtag blessed to have an offer from the University of Alabama. But like that was how he did it. Like he like was like sort of like he had like a picture of himself like as like a picture of like a random high school football player. Then like had like his name there, and then like basically started tweeting out offers. And I think the recruiting sites just picked him up and gave him a ranking, right?
Yeah, I mean, that was definitely my hope there. But, you know, I think if you had to actually bring up somebody that I think a lot of people are going to be talking about, and it's not necessarily a sleeper, but someone like T.J. Hockenson, you know, we talked about that before. I mean, just such a great tight end prospect. And, you know, that position, I think, is going to become increasingly more valuable as teams move towards some of the more popular offensive schemes that we've seen there. I mean, you need someone that's, you know, an adept blocker like he is, but also a, you know, really, really talented wide receiver. So, you know, I think a lot of people are already comparing him to like a Gronk heir apparent type player. So I think that it'll be interesting to see how he works out, but certainly someone I think that the buzz will grow around as we get closer here.
Yeah, maybe like the first guy. Like, I don't know, like Gronk's one of those people, those guys that's like such an outrageous athlete that like you don't hear a lot of people compared to him, you know? And like I feel like Favre was that way too, right? Like until Mahomes, like there aren't a ton of quarterbacks you hear compared to Favre because he was so unique, and Mahomes was
every quarterback compared to Favre, right? But like one that finally makes sense.
Finally makes sense, right? And so maybe this is the guy that finally makes sense. As far as the first tight end that we've seen that maybe actually is worth being compared to Rob Gronkowski. My guy is Andy Isabella, and not just because he's from UMass and not because he grew up in Ohio, but because I think that there is going to be – I think it's going to be really interesting to hear people talk about him and then see him run his 40. He is a little white guy who I think a lot of people are going to sort of look at and say, oh, well, that's like Wes Welker or – that's like Julian Edelman or whatever. And I'm telling you, like, from what I understand, this guy's going to run like 4.25. Like, this guy might be the fastest guy in the class. And so I'm interested to see how fast he runs. I know we've said it a bunch of different places. It's been written a bunch of different places. But he actually beat Denzel Ward in the Ohio State like track championships in the 100 meters. And Denzel Ward, I believe, I don't know if you have this up, Connor, was it 4.34 or something last year? Like Ward ran like an absurd time. And this guy beat, you know, Denzel Ward in a track meet. And so Andy Isabella is the guy that I think is going to be, he's just an interesting prospect because I think people might have him pegged as one thing and he's something else entirely. So there you go.
It's a good primer for our listeners.
Absolutely. Absolutely. All right. I appreciate you guys coming out. All right. We'll jump right into the six pack. You guys know how this works. I put the call for questions out on Twitter. You ask, I answer six. If I pick yours, you not only get that answer here, you also get a like on Twitter. That means I hit that little heart there. Question number one, this is from Funhouse, our friends at Funhouse. At back after this, better prospect at the same pre-combine stage, Joey or Nick Bosa? I think it's awfully close. The feedback that I've gotten, again, I'm not a scout, but I've watched a lot of both these guys play, and I watched pretty much every game either of these guys played as collegians. And, you know, I've got the feedback from different teams and everything else. I think that Joey was a more refined prospect, probably a little bit more developed prospect. But Nick is probably a little bit more powerful and maybe a little bit more athletic. And so I think they're both very, very, very developed guys for their age, coming out. Joey was, Nick is, and I think they're very close. You know, the one thing you also look at with the two, Joey's a little more linear where Nick is a little bit more powerful. And so they're similar. They're both very developed. They're both very refined as pass rushers. They both have hands that, I mean, they're like ninjas out there the way they use their hands, which is a credit to the Ohio State D-line coach, Larry Johnson. I think Joey might get a slight nod there, but it's very, very close. Question number two, this is from Michael Mannix, that at the O Mannix, the most likely scenario for Kraft based on typical John cases is for the charge to be dropped, no admission of guilt in community service. What would the NFL do in this case? I still believe that the NFL will fine him the maximum amount, which is $500,000, which isn't much in the grand scheme of things if you are an NFL owner. And I believe that they will suspend him. And I think that what we'll see here is that this one lines up a little bit more with Jim Irsay versus what we saw with Jerry Richardson. The reason why Jerry Richardson's case involved the workplace, whereas Jim Irsay's case was more of a personal matter. Kraft's case is more a personal matter. And so this isn't about just a place that's rotten. This isn't about a workplace that's gone awry. It's more bringing embarrassment to the league. And so I think that it makes sense to punish him the same as Jim Irsay. The collateral damage there, of course, he wouldn't be at the banner raising ceremony, which would give this case some new life when we get to September. And I think it could wind up affecting the timing on when he gets into the Hall of Fame. Question number three from Brady forces Jets fans to cry at Pats_1988. I had two questions for this guy. Hi, two questions for you. What do scouts think of Dexter Lawrence? Is he a better nose tackle than Vita Vey or Eddie Goldman? Thanks and best regards from Austria. Love the Austrians. I am first generation Austrian on my mom's side. Shout out to everybody in Vienna and elsewhere in Austria. I think that the feedback that I've gotten, Dexter Lawrence is a like five star, to borrow a recruiting term, five star nose tackle prospect. The question is how you value the nose tackle. He can be a little disruptive. He's a mountain of a guy. He's going to be impossible to run on 2-3 years into the NFL. And so I think Dexter Lawrence is a better nose tackle prospect than Vita Vey or Eddie Goldman. The question is how you view the nose tackle. And so he's as good at his job as I think anybody in the draft is at theirs. It's just a run stopper in 2019 doesn't have the same value that he might have, say, 5, 10, 15 years ago. Question number four, this is from Don Ridenour. That is at Don Ridenour, and we're going to get multiple questions from him today. How much per year does Dak get? I would say that there's the baseline right now for a franchise quarterback going forward is going to be right around $30 million per. Could the Cowboys get him to take less? Maybe. If they did, I think the compromise would be guaranteeing more of his money down the line. But my guess is that they would have to get him in at about $30 million per. And really what you want to look at is the price of the franchise tags. The franchise tags for quarterbacks this year are at $25 million, or going to be right over $25 million. Next year, I would expect that to jump maybe a couple million. So then we'd be looking at, you know, if you wanted to, you'd franchise him at, say, $27, $28 million in 2020. Then you might have to franchise him again. We'd be talking about well over $30 million in 2021. Do you want to put yourself in that position where you're year-to-year with your quarterback the way the Redskins were with Kirk Cousins? Dak might want to do that. I mean, Dak might want to do that because it could get him to the market a few years down the line. My guess is they wind up finding some sort of accord, though. And my feeling would be that it would be somewhere in the $30 million per range. Maybe not beating Aaron Rodgers out, but, you know, if you look at the history of quarterback contracts, usually the highest paid guy is the last one to get paid, so it wouldn't be far off. This is another question from Don Ridenour. That's at Don Ridenour. We'll give you two because you're a loyal listener. Any chance the Eagles make a play for Antonio Brown? The answer to that question, in my mind, is no. Two reasons why: they've got a little bit of a cap issue. They've already got a lot of money tied up in Alshon Jeffrey at the receiver position. They've also got the future of Nelson Aguilar on their own roster to consider. So I would say no. I don't think that they'll make a play for Antonio Brown, even though it's the sort of move that I think Howie Roseman would generally look at. Just logistically where they are right now, I think it'd be kind of tough for them to do that. And finally, question number six from ASAP. That's the S has got like a dollar sign through it. Brad at 758. Who are the Chiefs taking with each pick? I don't know who the Chiefs are going to take with each of their picks, but I will say this: defense, 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 defense. Look for pressure players. I think that's one of the big things. With Steve Spagnuolo, I think you're going to be seeing players that are capable of pressuring from different levels. He's always been one of the more aggressive defensive play callers out there. That's his legacy as a Jim Johnson guy. And so I would say this is a good draft to be the Chiefs taking a player at the bottom of the first round. I think it's the rare year where drafting there, you're still going to be able to find yourself a productive pass rusher, which if they tag Dee Ford and let Justin Houston go, they may need. I would say defense across the board, and it makes sense for them to maybe take somebody along the line of scrimmage or a pressure linebacker in the first round. Appreciate all you guys coming out. As always, we appreciate every single one of you guys listening to us each and every week, and we welcome your feedback. You can get to me on social media at Albert Breer on Twitter, at Albert _ Breer on Instagram, at Albert R. Breer on Facebook, and always remember to listen to all the podcasts in the MMQB NFL podcast feed. That includes our podcast. It also includes the Monday morning podcast featuring Gary Gramling and Andy Benoit. You can get us on Spotify, TuneIn, Stitcher, Google Play, Apple Podcasts, wherever you guys get your shows. We're there same time next week. We'll be wrapping up the Combine, and we'll see you guys next.